This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name is Chris Scott and I'm here with Jason Haas. How are you, Jason?
I'm doing well. How are you, Chris?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. You're the general manager there at Tablas Creek Vineyards in Paso Robles.
I am. The locals say Paso Robles, not Paso Robles. So, I do speak Spanish, and it took me years to learn to mispronounce it correctly.
Can you say it again? So, you know, I get it wrong.
Paso Robles. So it Paso rhymes Robles. With like nobles.
Oh, Paso Robles. Okay. Is it the way I'm saying? I pronounce everything wrong, and my wife is. She just gets absolutely mortified at my French pronunciation sometimes. So Paso Robles.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
It's hard unless you're saying the name of the full name of the town and its old Spanish name, which would be El Paso de Robles. Locals say Paso Robles or just Paso.
Okay. What I want to talk about today is Paso Robles, the wine region, and just get a feel for it and maybe look at how you guys, as I think officially you're called Rhone Rangers, or the introduction of Rhone varietals into what was historically maybe an old Zinfandel, dry farm Zinfandel sort of environment, and just talk about that as well. So can we start off with where Paso Robles is?
Yes. So Paso Robles is in the central coast of California. So it's almost exactly dead center between the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's about 4 hours away from each by car. Mm-hmm. It's separated from the Pacific Ocean by one range of mountains, which is really what dictates our climate. So even though we're only 20 miles from the ocean, those mountains in between us get up to about 3,000 feet high. So that holds back a lot of the direct influence of the fog and that kind of Pacific cooling and allows it to warm up. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty warm region, particularly during the day. But it's so dry that the nights are really cold. So you have this massive swing in temperature between day and night, really every day throughout the year. And we've got this kind of classic Mediterranean climate where it's wet in the winter, quite dry in the summer. And that was really what brought us here. I mean, we came here knowing that we wanted to do Rhone varieties, and we chose Paso to suit that idea.
The region itself, though, is not a homogeneous region. A lot of people divide it up into a sort of west side and east side. You guys are on the west side, aren't you, on the cooler side?
We are. It's a little bit cooler on the west, but I think it's probably more important that it's wetter on the west, because that's the storms come off the Pacific and they drop their rain over the higher altitude terrain, which is pretty much all west of town. And then by the time you get to the town, which is in the kind of the center of the Paso Robles AVA, you're only at about 700 feet elevation, and that's a lot drier. We get 26 inches of rain a year on average. The town of Paso gets 12, even though it's only 10 miles away. And you can be inside the Paso Robles AVA, say 10 miles east of Paso, and be in a place that only gets 7 inches of rain a year. So it is a little cooler where we are, but it's mostly wetter and more mountainous, more rugged, and there's more limestone in the soil.
Okay, we'll talk about limestone later on, but that means that 26 inches, and it's mainly falling in winter. So we're going to talk about water management at a later date, but like a lot of people sort of say that, and you probably don't want to say this, but that maybe the more premium wines are on the west side and the more commercial styles are on the east side. Is that true? Because I've read that in quite a few places.
I think it's a generalization. It's not true. It's not untrue, but I'm not sure it's super helpful. The main differences are that the east side is easier to farm. It's less mountainous. It was already cleared for ranching. And so if people wanted to go in and farm mechanically and plant and produce for a little higher production, the only place to do that was on the east. And so on the west side, it's too mountainous to farm mechanically. There's oak forests everywhere. So it's little pockets of land that were cleared often for nut farming. This was the center of nut production in California.
What was that, macadamias?
No, it was mostly almonds and walnuts and pistachios.
Yeah, almonds are very water intense, aren't they?
They are. And you can dry farm almond trees out here in West Paso because there's enough rain on an annual basis. And it was not until the canals opened up the southern part of the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley in California, to irrigation. And that was where a lot of the nut production moved. But before that, it was all out here. So So yeah, I mean, I think the West Paso, if you drive out into it, it's full of like old big oak forests. Robles means oaks in Spanish. It's technically
Okay.
the pass of the oaks. East of town, it's more likely to be kind of rolling grassland. So
Sure.
it is easier to farm on the east side of town, certainly easier to farm mechanically. And so that sort of dictated the sort of developments that have gone in there. But I think the east side of town, particularly if you're in the southeast where there's more limestone, is also capable of making really terrific wines.
Okay, let's talk about the grape varieties. Actually, let's talk about this limestone. You keep bringing it up. And I know, for example, that for some reason, I did not know this, that Bocastel, which is one of your parent owners, if you like, they've got a bit of limestone in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, which I was a bit surprised about, because I always think of Châteauneuf-du-Pape being sort of, big stones rolled off from granite from the Central Massive and the Alps and things like that, rather than limestone coming up through the bottom. But I was reading that you guys found this site because it had the limestone.
Yeah, so let's talk about Châteauneuf-du-Pape quickly because you raised it. So yeah, we're co-founded by the Perrin family from Château de Beaucastel, who've been farming in Châteauneuf-du-Pape since the early 20th century. And if you're in Châteauneuf, or you see pictures, like it famously has those galets roulés, the
Yeah, big
rounded river
pudding
stone
stones, yeah.
that sit on the surface. But those aren't native to the Rhone. Those are native, as you said, to the Alps mostly. And they got rolled down. The reason they're smooth is they got tumbled as they were being rolled hundreds of miles down the Rhone River as the Rhone River was draining the glaciers out of the Alps at the end of the Ice Ages. So when you're at the Rhone, particularly when you're in the Châteauneuf-du-Pape area, that was the area where that kind of canyon valley opens up, and these rocks that have been tumbling fast for couple hundred miles settled down to the bottom, but they sit on top of the soils that have been there for millennia, for whatever, for centuries, millennia, millions of years. And those are all old seabed. Those are these calcareous, either limestone or limestone derivative soils. And the rocks, those galets roulés, are so hard that the vines just go around them. The roots grow around those galets roulés through the topsoil down into that limestone element. And it's such a valuable thing because it has the right balance of water absorption and drainage to keep from having standing water around your roots, but also to keep things from getting so dry that there's nothing to be found. And so that was one of the main things that we were looking for when we were looking for a spot to found what would eventually become Tablas Creek, is we were looking for a place that had enough rainfall to dry farm, the right kind of climate to do well with Rhone varieties, and these calcareous soils that would allow us to retain the water that you get in the winter in California and gradually give it back to the vines in the summer. And you can't find that in Napa or Sonoma. You can't find it in the Sierra foothills. You can't find it in Mendocino. It's really just in the central coast of California, in this little sliver of land where you're actually on the Pacific tectonic plate instead of the North American tectonic plate.
Yeah. And I presume that because you've got the big fault line, the San Andreas fault that runs up. So I imagine it's the uplift from that that's causing them to be at that, what, 400 meters or whatever, where you guys are, altitude that you guys are at.
Yep, that's exactly it. It's the mountain range is the Santa Lucia Mountains. It's basically the coast range that is the western part of California. And that's a place where instead of subducting underneath as ocean plates usually do, because they're heavier when they come into contact with a continental plate, it caught and kind of knuckled up this coastal range. So we have what are relatively young marine sediments, so like 10 million years old, which is young in geologic terms. We have those in some cases, 2,000 to 3,000 feet above sea level.
Yeah. The other thing that's quite handy, I think, with limestone, people don't really talk about it though, is that normally if you've got an alkaline soil such as limestone, it's going to help big up the acidity in your wines. And if you're in a Mediterranean climate that you say you are, then holding on to that acidity, even with good diurnals, is always going to be a something you want to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such an important piece. And it appears that it's the kind of oversaturation of calcium, because limestone is calcium carbonate, and all of those calcium ions, they displace potassium ions. And potassium is one of the micronutrients that grapevines use to break down acids. So if you have less availability of potassium, which you do in calcium-rich soils, grapevines break down acids more slowly in the grapes, so you have more left at harvest time.
Oh, is that what it is? I just know, for example, in places like Beaujolais, where they've got granite, which is an acid-based soil, you land up with lower acid wines because of that. And with limestone chalk, you land up with higher acid. So I thought it was to do with the acidity of the soils, but it's not. It's a different process, is it?
It's a different process, but you're right that in general terms, that's true. Acid soils produce lower acid wines, whereas basic soils produce higher acid wines.
All right, let's talk about these Rhone varietals that you guys planted up, because was there much in the way of Rhone varietals before you guys got going? Because I think historically, Paso Robles was known for its old vine dry farms Zinfandel.
Yeah, so there was not much in the way of Rhone varieties anywhere in California, like let alone Paso. There historically had been some experiments with grapes like Grenache and Mourvèdre, even back pre-Prohibition. And then in the 1970s, there were some people who were starting to experiment with Syrah, and same thing with Viognier. There's a little bit of that was brought in, but Paso, there was no epicenter for that, and Paso really hadn't been known for that, but. We figured we didn't have any connection to any part of California when we started. We were looking everywhere from Napa to Santa Barbara. And we decided that Paso was the best match in terms of soils and climate and rainfall that we could find anywhere in California. And the fact that there wasn't a history of Rhones in Paso, it didn't really matter that much. I mean, we were the 17th winery in Paso Robles when we founded Tablas Creek in 1989. So it wasn't like there was this massively well-established history of anything. And we figured that if the raw materials were there to do something great with these grape varieties, then the reputation would follow.
And you guys have been quite leaders in that, in terms of bringing in cuttings from the Rhone Valley.
Yeah, that's again one of the things of deciding to focus on a category of wines that people weren't really doing yet. Like we had to do so many things from scratch. And really the first decision that we made was to import cuttings of all of the principal Rhone varieties from Bocastel. And that was really driven by the fact that there were grapes that we wanted to work with that had never been used in California before. We knew that grapes like Grenache Blanc and Coonoise and Picpoul were going to be useful, but we made the decision that we didn't want to just live with the clones of the other things that happened to be here either. We didn't want to live with the Grenache clone that was a key piece of Gallo-hardy Burgundy because you could produce it at 20 tons an acre and it would get sweet. Like we wanted to have the same clones that they had at Bocastel. So we brought in new cuttings of everything. We did it legally. So we waited 3 years for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to test these vines and declare them virus-free. We built our own grapevine nursery on site. We used that to plant our own vineyard. But we also made the decision early on to make these clones available to other growers who wanted to buy and plant them because we felt that that would help the whole category get established in California. And we ended up kind of falling into a second business through doing that. And we've sold something like 5 million grapevine cuttings to 600 growers up and down the West Coast over the last 25 years.
Oh, nice. Nice. Was it an actual profit center as a business, or was it more of a, if there's more people doing it, then you're going to get traction in terms of consumer awareness?
It was definitely not a profit center. We figure we lost several hundred thousand dollars trying to do this as a business over the years.
Oh, really?
But our goal was to break even doing it, not to make money at it. I'm not thrilled that we lost money at it either. But the goal was to get these clones out into circulation and help the whole category improve.
Do you want to just tell us, you've got different levels of wines in your wine range, and I noticed, for example, your top wine's the Esprit, and I noticed that it's Mourvèdre dominated. And that's ballsy, because even in the Rhone Valley, Mourvèdre is not always the most reliable planter. You see it really quite right down by the time you're getting down into the bottom end, middle of Spain, but Mourvèdre up in the Rhone Valley isn't always, it ripens regular enough, but it's always a bit player, whereas you've gone for it as a dominant player.
And that really follows what they do at Bocastel. I mean, Bocastel is unusual in Châteauneuf-du-Pape for relying as much as they do on Mourvèdre. Typically, the Mourvèdre plays an equal or slightly greater role to Grenache in the Bocastel Red. And it's all based on the idea that, in general, the finest wines that a variety will make generally happen at the northern edge of its range. I mean, it forces a longer growing season and a slower ripening. You generally get more balance, a little less accumulation of sugar and alcohol. the idea behind a spot, behind focusing on Mourvèdre on the red side and exactly the same calculus with Roussanne, which is our lead white grape in our Esprit White, was these are grapes that should stay on the vine for a long time, even in that warm California sun, hopefully give us good complexity, good reflection of the soils. And I think it's turned out to be true. That does not mean that they are easy grapes to grow. They are both hard grapes to grow because they take so long to ripen, because it's so dry in the summer here that you are basically like just trying to keep them going as you get into the second half of the summer with enough vigor to get through ripening at the end of October, or even last year, we didn't finish until the second week of November. The reward is that you get something that has a lot of complexity. The risks are that if you get early rain, like maybe some of your crop won't even come in. But we're willing to take that risk because we feel like what we get from the Mourvèdre and the Roussanne lots is so compelling.
All right, Jason, just before we finish up, how can the guys get hold of you or find out more about you guys?
So we're pretty easy to find, I hope. We're at Tubless Creek on all the major social media channels. But one thing that people might not know exists is that we've been writing a blog for the last almost 20 years, diving into everything from grape growing to winemaking to geology to wine business to marketing to you name it. If it's a part of what you would do as an estate winery in California, I'm sure we've written about it. So if people like those deep dives into things like that, that's linked off of the homepage of our website, which is just tubblesscreek.com.
All right then, mate. We'll wrap it up there. Cheers very much.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.